You folks can amend the record.
I think Mr. Dimitrakopoulos and I are accustomed to these pronunciations. Good morning, Chief Justice Moon, and members of justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court. May it please the court. GEICO has asked to reserve 5 minutes of its oral argument for rebuttal opportunity. In addition, and with the consent of this court, 5 minutes of my initial presentation is being reserved and ceded to the insurance commissioner of the state of Hawaii in support of the amicus curiae brief presented by the insurance division. Accordingly, I have asked the clerk to notify me at the point when I'm 20 minutes into my presentation. Justices, the trial court made three errors in ruling on Gillen's motion for summary judgment. The first error was that the trial court concluded that the mutual consent of a PIP claimant is required when an insurer retains an expert to assist in the evaluation of a PIP claim. The trial court's errors of function of concluding that a PIP medical examination is the same thing under HRS 431.10C 308.5 as a PIP medical examination. The second error by the trial court was a conclusion that, based on that interpretation, GEICO violated that statute when it based a PIP denial of Ms. Gillen's claim for benefits on an evaluation of medical records that was done by an expert GEICO retained without first obtaining Ms. Gillen's consent to that review. The third error made by the trial court was a ruling that concluded, as a function of the two previous decisions, that GEICO could not use at trial any reference to the review that had been done by GEICO's expert and formed the basis on which GEICO issued its denial. Accordingly, that error follows from this court's ruling in TIG versus Kalhani, which is to deprive GEICO of the opportunity at trial to dispute the substance of the claims that Ms. Gillen asserts she is entitled to by virtue of being a PIP GEICO insured.
Forgive what may be a naive question, but aren't you the respondent?
I understood that I was the appellant. Did we put ourselves out of order?
I was expecting to hear from the petitioner first, but if that's what you folks have agreed to, it's whatever.
I didn't agree to it. All right, proceed.
The decision by the Intermediate Court of Appeals corrected these errors, consistent with interpretations of 308.5, previously published by the insurance commissioner in the Weigel decision, and also as evaluated both on the language of the statute and the legislative history by the United States Federal District Court in Engle versus Liberty Mutual. GEICO does not dispute that the legislative changes to the PIP statute in the year 2000 placed the mutual consent of the claimant as an element of a PIP medical examination. The clear purpose of that amendment was to provide a neutral examiner when the claimant was exposed to the personal and invasive nature of a physical examination requested by an insurance company.
Anywhere in the legislative history, does the legislature say that that's the reason?
I cannot give the court a citation. I believe that is true.
I don't recall that the legislature said the reason we're going to impose these requirements, i.e. that the examiner be neutral, is because we're getting into or intruding into the physical privacy of the claimant.
And Justice Okoba, you are correct that there are additional considerations in that legislative the adoption of that amendment, which included notions of neutrality and fairness in the independent medical examination process.
In fact, the only justification they seemingly gave was to contain costs, that if you had a neutral examiner, then you wouldn't have both sides fighting over an evaluation. And if both sides agreed, then fine. If they didn't agree, then you went to court to have the court appoint the examiner. And so that was, I don't know, from reading the legislative history, that was the basic purpose behind
it. And I would...
The legislature is concerned with cost containment.
Yes, certainly it was, and I don't dispute the court's reading of that legislative history, because there really is no dispute that mutual consent is required when a PIP medical examination is requested by an insurer. That really is not GEICO's issue. There is also no dispute that in 1998, the section 308.5 was amended to prevent PIP medical examination charges from being unbundled by the providers of those services. And the statute was amended to prevent the examiners from separately charging for component parts of a medical examination.
Are physical examinations sometimes substituted by record examinations?
That is precisely the situation here.
Is that in the majority of cases?
I don't know how to answer the court's question.
Is it in a substantial number of cases?
I still don't know how to answer the court's question. I have no idea in the scope of the number of claims.
In this particular case,
it was requested.
It was used as a substitute for physical examination.
Physical examination served no purpose in the context of this claim because there was no dispute that at the time Ms. Gillen was resuming her medical treatment with Dr. Keller that she had neck pain. The question that GEICO had was whether the neck pain that arose in September of 2003 arose from motor vehicle accident injury sustained by Ms. Gillen in December of 2002. So a medical examination with a physical examination of the plaintiff did not address GEICO's interest. What GEICO did here was retain its own expert to answer its concerns about whether this was a meritorious claim.
Counsel, ultimately, what resolves this appeal is an exercise in statutory construction, isn't it? Specifically, the term independent medical examinations, as it appears in 431.10c.308.5, and more particularly, whether a record review without more can constitute an independent medical examination. Isn't that right?
Yes, Justice Levinson.
Would you agree that the term independent medical examinations, as it appears in that statute, is at least ambiguous?
No. I think it is very clearly defined to include a physical examination, a history taking from the patient, a review of records, and the generation of a report.
So you read in including and then the recitation of the various components as a legislative definition of independent medical examination, and in the absence of any of those components, there has been no independent medical examination. Is that correct?
I think so, but I'd like to restate it. And I would restate it by saying that a medical examination begins with a physical examination and includes, for purposes of this cost containment provision, a requirement that whoever does that physical examination requested by an insurance company also include within a single charge for that examination the practitioner's effort in reviewing records, interviewing the patient, and generating a report. But
if hypothetically then a carrier were to request an independent medical examination, the statutory mutual consent was obtained with the claimant, and the physician did everything except that for whatever reason, the physician did not submit a written report, there would have been no independent medical examination. Isn't that true?
I'm not certain that that's true. I believe that an independent medical examination at least begins with a physical examination of the claimant. Now, whether...
Don't a lot of medical examinations begin with taking a history?
Yes, they do. But I would...
And often is the taking of a history not preceded by record review?
Yes, they are.
So a physical laying on of hands is not necessarily the first phase of a medical examination, is it?
Maybe not the first phase, but an essential phase, yes. That's what differentiates a medical examination.
Well, there are courts that disagree, are there not?
I don't know of any. And I believe...
You're unaware of any split in authority?
That says that a independent medical examination
may consist exclusively of a record review?
No, Your Honor, what I meant to say was I know of no decision which says that an independent medical examination is other than involving physical examination of a claimant or
You're
plaintiff.
You're unaware of any case law in any jurisdiction that holds that a record review by a physician without more can constitute an independent medical examination.
Correct. And I believe in the context of our court, of our legislature's review of the issues, that the ability to retain an expert to evaluate and inform an insurer's concerns or questions about the validity of the claim is not precluded by the history of the changes that were made to the statute by the legislature.
Did you say that the term independent medical examination is not ambiguous? Then the term medical indicates that the examination has to be made by a person with a medical license?
Certainly.
And so the fact that adjusters may deny claims, adjusters I'm assuming have no medical licenses, those would not be included under the statute. You agree with that?
An adjuster's review of...
Denial.
Denial is...
Example of a claim.
Right. It's not based on expert opinion. Correct.
Okay. So in Engel, Judge Mulway tried to say or said that insurers under this rule would not be able to use in-house persons to deny claims.
I didn't take that from Judge Mulway's reasoning, Justice Okoba. I think that what she was saying is that insurance companies are unfettered by the statute in the tools that they may use to evaluate a claim. I think she would also, or the analysis also anticipates, that when a physical examination is involved, that is an independent medical examination subject to mutual consent. And GEICO agrees with that. But that doesn't mean that because a record review might be a component part of an independent medical examination, that it is the equivalent of an independent medical examination or intended by the legislature to allow a claimant to intrude into an insurer's review of a PIP claim to determine whether it is meritorious or not.
I think you're correct. And as far as intrusion is concerned, I think Judge Mulway said, well, you know, adjusters as well as independent medical people could deny these claims, so there's really not much of a difference between them.
I believe that Judge Mulway said that nothing in the statute requires any quantum of proof or investigation to support a denial. I'm not sure that I agree that she said exactly as you might have stated. But I believe that what Judge Mulway's conclusion was is that there is a balancing of public policy interests in the context of first-party PIP claims that allow insurers to consult with their own experts and inform their decision to pay or not pay a certain claim. And Ms. Gillen's history is precisely such a situation. She did receive speedy and equitable reparations for the medical treatment she received immediately after the accident. She went to Castle. She had x-rays and was evaluated for neurologic issues. She was diagnosed and released with a cervical strain. She consulted her primary care physician 3 weeks later, and she received a course of acupuncture and chiropractic treatment. All of those benefits were promptly paid by GEICO as PIP benefits. Then Ms. Gillen voluntarily and on her own stopped treating for 6 months. When she renewed her claim for PIP benefits, it was now 9 months post-accident, and she was seeing a new doctor, and she was presenting with different symptoms than were ever reported initially to Castle or the doctors that saw her during the first 3 months of her treatment.
When GEICO retained its out-of-state medical examiner, did it inform the examiner that his fees would be subject to the worker compensation schedule as provided under the statute?
No. And the provider is a licensed physician in the state of Hawaii.
Counsel, all of what you just recited being the case, doesn't the disposition of this matter still come down to whether an independent medical examination was conducted?
Yes, that's precisely the case.
Do you take issue with the following definition of independent medical examination? An assessment of a person's physical condition and health that is made by an impartial healthcare professional, usually a physician.
I do not, but there was no attempt by GEICO here to do an independent medical examination. This was an insurance company that was retaining its own expert to assist its claims review process. There was no pretense.
It was Dr. Keller, correct?
No, Dr. Keller is one of the
I'm sorry,
claimants.
Dr. Hector.
Correct.
Dr. Hector did an assessment of Ms. Gillen's physical condition, did he not, and health?
No, he reviewed her medical records. He did not assess Ms. Gillen at all, did not conduct an examination of her.
I'm not asking whether he laid hands on her. I'm asking whether he assessed her physical condition and health in reaching his conclusion as to the reasonableness and necessity of particular treatment.
He did not. What he did was review the medical records of her initial treatment to determine whether, from a reasonably medical probability, that the cervical strain injuries Ms. Gillen sustained in December would still be symptomatic by the time she was seen by Dr. Keller.
And that doesn't entail, among other things, an assessment of her physical condition?
He did not assess her physical condition. Her physical condition at the time of his assessment was not relevant to GEICO's evaluation. They were concerned about causation, whether her need for treatment with Dr. Keller was appropriate, reasonable, and necessarily incurred as a result of the December 2002 motor vehicle accident. May I defer the floor to the Insurance Commissioner?
Thank you, Chief Justice. Associate Justices, thank you very much for allowing me to file an amicus brief in this matter and to make a few comments. This is a very important case from the Insurance Division's point of view for the integrity of the reforms of the legislature in 97, 98, and 2000. The reforms, as Justice Koba mentioned earlier, were primarily concerned about controlling costs. They're interested in controlling costs by streamlining the process and making it more simple. As a result of those reforms, we had the largest drop in insurance premiums for the state of Hawaii from 1907 to 2001. In 1997, Hawaii was second highest in the nation, and in 2001, we were 21st in the nation. Now, these reforms were primarily, as I said, concerned about streamlining and simplifying the system, and a part of the reforms was to remove the peer review process, which was very contentious at the time, also streamline other processes, and remove all the mandates on insurance coverage that individuals had, requiring only now basic coverage, and then if they desired to have optional coverage, to pursue that. In our amicus brief, we do argue that we do agree with the ICA's decision in this matter, and we do agree with the arguments of Defendant GEICO in this matter, and believe that the plain language of the statute is clear and unambiguous. We do believe the amendment in 98 was a minor adjustment intended to avoid separate charges for each ancillary procedure, not as a definition, because it's under a statute labeled limitation of charges. Record reviews are a part of the IME, not an IME in and of themselves, just as nobody in this case is arguing that history taking is an independent IME on its own that requires all the restrictions.
It might not be prudent medical practice, but assume hypothetically that as a result of a carrier's request for an IME, a physician conducted a physical examination only, didn't do a history taking, didn't review records. Would that be an independent medical examination?
Yes, I believe it would.
All right, so physical examination without more is sufficient to equal IME?
Correct.
Assuming that the examiner is independent?
Correct. Correct. And then if they do the other procedures, this statute says you can't charge separately for all these different procedures. You have to have one charge, which is how it's also in the statute required to have one charge.
Wouldn't that make those activities then activities that fall within the four corners of an IME?
They are activities that are often parts of an IME.
And they can be constituent elements of an IME.
Yes, but individually not an IME in and of themselves.
Except for physical exam, and that can.
Right, because that's primarily what we're talking about with an examination. And that's in line with workers' comp code for complex consultation, which the law previously referred to. It also lists all of these different components, as well as diagnosis and plan for recovery. And that gives one code for one charge for those. So that's consistent.
If IME is a physical examination, then why does the statute go on to name other types of examinations, like record review, and taking history, etc.? Well, if all it, a physical examination equals an independent medical examination, why, then why say anything more?
Well, because I believe the court or the legislature found that they wanted to limit charges. That's the name of this particular statute. They wanted to control costs, as you rightly stated. And they found that there were being multiple charges, both for physical exam and then another charge for a record review, another charge for history taking.
Could you interpret this statute, though, as treating the separate items following the word including as being separate and independent acts or transactions that might amount to what the legislature designated as an independent medical examination?
I would not interpret it as separate acts that would be considered an independent medical examination.
No, you would not. My question is, could you?
I think that it requires a leap of logic to do so, because, as I say, you have independent medical examinations, including record review, history taking, reports. So if you have a record review is in and of itself an exam, well, did they also mean history taking is? Also the other reports? So I think that that's one logical problem with interpreting it in that way.
So that if the answer to Justice Acoba's question were yes, one could construe the statute such that each of the constituents enumerated in the statute could in and of themselves constitute an IME. That would render the statute at least ambiguous, would it not?
That would, but I would take, as I said, I think a leap of logic to do that, and would entail additional costs and expenses as opposed to limiting costs and expenses. Because if you require the consultation, referral to the commissioner for record review, or
my question was intended, at least I intended it to be fairly narrow. Mm-hmm. If you could read the statute in the way that Justice Acoba suggests, then at the very least there would be ambiguity in the statute, would there not?
Well, yes, but as I say, I don't think you can do it logically. And so, therefore, I don't think it's ambiguous. I don't think it's unclear.
If you could treat the statute as setting out separate constituent parts of what might be an IME or independent parts of what might be an IME, wouldn't that, in effect, save costs? I mean, if you can do an IME and on the basis of that IME come to a conclusion without a physical examination, then wouldn't you save costs?
Well, you're basically describing what a record review is, where you're not doing an IME, you're not doing an examination,
but
you're looking at the records.
You're not doing an IME, but the statute itself says an IME includes record review, etc.
As a part, but if that's all you're doing, there are, as has been noted, numerous procedures that an insurance company will use in order to evaluate a claim. And as I believe you noted before, an adjuster may deny a claim, may look at and evaluate it. That, of course, is not included in here at all. There may be other analysis or reviews that go into a denial of a claim. And there may be a record review. There may be the intrusive exam. Previously, under peer review, there were record reviews that required consultation, that required the approval of the commissioner if an agreement couldn't be made. That was extremely contentious, extremely costly. There were over 4,500 per year in 95, 96, and 97. Now, under this procedure, last year we had 153 complaints of denial of claim. Some of those were multiple complaints, so those get consolidated in the hearing. And ultimately, when they came before me, some of them were subtle, Ultimately, when they came before me for final decision and order, I had 18 final decisions in order. So that's a tremendous streamlining and savings in cost and time for everyone. So it's worked very well in that regard.
In connection with that, the petitioner argues that the reason the legislature required that the examiner be neutral, i.e. independent, was that that was in effect a substitute for the peer review that had taken place earlier, because the results of both would be to deny a claim for reimbursement for treatment. If that's true, then doesn't that mean that the examiner truly has to be independent, i.e. either the parties have to agree to the choice of the examiner, or if they cannot agree, that the court will appoint one?
Well, I believe the legislature, number one, recognized the fact that you may not be able to find a truly neutral person, and that all of these things in their language, they say, you should take into account. You should take into account that the doctor is not somebody who makes most of his money from IMEs. You should take that into account and set up a procedure to try to find the most neutral person. The argument for plaintiffs, I believe, would actually take us back to that peer review, contentious peer review situation, and really undo the reforms that the legislature did.
Well, you know, you and Geico talk about intrusion on the process and that the insurer should have the ultimate say as far as its position. But the statute provides that the court, if the parties cannot agree, will make the ultimate determination. So if the court, you can assume, is neutral, then there isn't really this apprehension about one party intruding into the province of the other party, is there?
Well, under the statute, the commissioner can choose the independent medical examiner if they can't agree. And I have frequent requests for choosing independent medical examiners. I'm not going to warrant that they're all neutral, but to the extent that we can, we try to make that. But they are frequently, I frequently have to make that choice, so that still is a process that's used. You know, as I say, I believe that for record review and less intrusive procedures, we need to be able to allow those in order to avoid the contentiousness and time delay and expense that under the prior system.
So if the record review, as in this case, does not resolve the issue, then I suppose a party could move for IME,
yes,
physical examination. So doesn't that just multiply rather than contain the costs?
No, because if they then did move for that, they would have to include the record review and the other procedures.
Precisely my point.
Cost.
You have two record reviews plus a physical examination.
But they only have one code that they can charge that under, and as the statute says, that all has to be included in one charge.
I agree with you, and that's why I think the legislature said you have one examination, it's a neutral one, everybody has to agree, you don't agree, you go to court, so that you don't have multiple examinations.
Well, and I would disagree in that I don't believe a record review is an examination. It's a review of the records, and it's something that enables somebody to come to a decision with some expert input.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
How many percentage-wise, I think you indicated record reviews you could rely upon to terminate PIP benefits, right?
Yes.
And so do you do with the IME, the physical examination, history taking?
Normally, yes.
You could just rely upon that history taken to...
They could, whether that would provide sufficient to support it.
And what do you... how do you characterize a report What does that mean? I mean,
the report may be reports of there may be other reports involved. There may be a final report on all that has occurred, the history taking record review in the IME. It may include a proposed plan for the best recovery from whatever illness there is, but it's kind of a catch-all.
Your interpretation of the statute is that every one of these things that we've talked about, record review and so forth, only the physical examination requires consent. Is that right? Looking at cost savings, the idea is that if the plaintiff agrees with this physical examination done by a medical doctor, agrees to the medical doctor, then the chances of dispute would be less, right?
Yes.
Theoretically.
Yes.
Okay, so with the IME, with the record review, if you would require consent, if you considered it as an IME and you said, look, you need consent, you would be saving costs. The fact that you didn't ask her to consent or him to consent, you're asking for more costs.
You would only save costs if you always got the consent, which certainly the past experience with the peer review was not the case. That proved to be very contentious. Now, under that system, they did not allow IMEs at all, so they were relying solely on the record reviews. But
anything else you want to say?
One final note, if I may, very briefly, is that the insurance division has many tools in order to prevent abuse in the claims handling process, and we do monitor it very closely. We are able to do market analysis. We are able to examine companies if we see any indication that there's abuse of the process, and have sanctions in order to do that. So we believe the process has worked well over the past 7 years, as interpreted by the ICA, and that should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chang.
Chief Justice Moon, Justice Levinson, Justice Nakayama, Justice Okoba, and Justice Lee, good morning. May it please the Court, Roy Chang and Harvey Dimitrakopoulos, on behalf of appellees, Margaret Gillen and Dr. Howard Keller. Your Honors, I think what we're going to ask the Court to do is to take a look at the IC opinion and to reverse it and to affirm the opinion of the lower court, Judge McKenna's decision. And the reason for that is because the decision of the ICA is not in keeping with the spirit and intent of the no-fault law. I think Judge McKenna did do a very extensive examination of the statute, as well as a very extensive examination of the legislative history. And based upon that, rendered her decision, which I believe is in keeping with the spirit and intent of the law. And the no-fault law was created as a means of providing a fair and equitable system of reparations. We took away from the injured person the right to sue the other driver, and in its place, we guaranteed to that injured person two things. One is the right to treatments, and secondly, the right to have her provider paid for those treatments. And those statutory rights are extremely important, and when we start taking away those rights, that's where the problem begins.
Mr. Chang?
Yes, Justice Levinson.
If I may interrupt, do you agree with what I said earlier that ultimately the resolution or disposition of this appeal is going to turn on our construction of the term independent medical evaluations as it appears in 308.5?
That is correct, Your Honor.
In order for there to be an independent medical examination, at the very least there has to be a medical examination. Isn't that true?
You're correct, Your Honor, in the sense that what the legislature was trying to control.
In the sense that it's a medical examination that's independent.
It's a medical opinion that's independent, correct.
All right. Carriers do record reviews in-house all the time. With respect to PIP claims and others, do they not?
They do.
if an adjuster in the employ of a carrier conducts such a record review and comes to a conclusion based on it, as a result of which the carrier takes a position, would you characterize that activity as a medical examination?
Not at all, Your Honor.
If a nurse in the employ of a character of a carrier conducted such an in-house record review, would you regard that as a medical examination?
No, Your Honor.
I don't think it's particularly common practice, if for no other reason given the cost, but if a carrier employed a medical doctor, an MD, on staff to conduct in-house record reviews, would you regard that as a medical examination?
Not in the definition that the legislature was talking about. As far as 308.5, no, it would not be a medical examination of the nature that they were trying to control.
So the only difference between that activity conducted by, well, that activity and what we're dealing with in the present case is that, in my hypothetical, the physician was an employee of the carrier, and in this case, the physician is not. Isn't that so?
That is true, Your Honor, and that's what the legislature was trying to control, the cost for paying for that expert opinion. And so if the carrier looks at a case and says, we need to hire an expert to render a medical opinion, that's when the statute kicks in. The statute kicks in to say that, okay, if you're going to do that, this is how much you can charge for that opinion. And then the selection of that person, that medical expert, must then comply with the consent provisions as well as the other requirements of same specialty and so forth. The reason the legislature did that was to avoid a summary termination of benefits just because insurance carrier decides to do that. This court stated in Vega versus National Union that the summary termination of statutory benefits may violate due process. So what we're talking about is the legislature created this due process system, and if the insurance companies are going to go around it, that violates due process. So what they wanted...
Well, in-house record reviews don't violate due process, do they?
That's correct. Because what is that issue? What this court talked about in Flores versus Barreto...
Don't we have an in-house record review here?
Well, they're all correct. But what I'm talking about, Your Honor, is what is the issue, the focus of the issue. So if the issue was the cost, are the doctor's charges too high? In Flores versus Barreto, this court said, yeah, you don't need to have a doctor to review that. You can have an adjuster take a look at it, a bill reviewer take a look at it.
What if a carrier wanted a doctor to do it?
Then they must comply.
To, you know, suck it up and pay a physician to... be on staff for the purpose of doing record reviews.
And is that a fair way of doing it? Because that's what the legislature wanted. If you're going to hire an expert medical opinion, it's got to be a fair and neutral one. They were trying to get away from the instances where insurance carriers can hire anybody that they want, like in a Rule 35 kind of examination. They are specifically saying this is a different one.
I'm not talking about retaining a physician or contracting with a physician to do an independent record review. I'm positing hypothetically a record review by a physician who is an employee of the carrier and conducts that record review in-house as an adjuster could, as a nurse could. The carriers aren't statutorily prohibited from doing that, are they?
Well, what are they then going to use that medical opinion for? If they're just going to use it as a basis to then hire another physician to do a different review or an independent physical examination, that's fine. If they're going to use it to then deny the claim of the doctor to be paid, that's when they've now stepped outside of their in-house arena into
so
that.
So an adjuster can do it, but a physician cannot.
adjuster can deny the benefit on certain grounds. If it's, again, a billing that was improper, violates the fee schedule, yes, the adjuster can do it. But if it's a decision based upon whether the treatments are appropriate, only a doctor can say whether the treatments are appropriate as to the community protocol for medical treatments. Was it necessary? If it's necessary, someone has to take a look at, are the treatments curative? Are they palliative? And so if he's just going to say, well, the bills are too high, that's one thing. But if they're going to go to the next level and then use that opinion to deny paying the doctor, that's where the problem begins. And that's what the legislature was trying to protect. It was the doctors.
GEICO and the insurance commissioner on the one hand and your clients on the other construe the operative statute quite divergently, do you not?
That is correct.
Doesn't that suggest some ambiguity in the statute?
There is certain case law, Your Honor, that says that if two sides can look at the same statute, arrive at two different conclusions, that yes, one could look at that statute as being ambiguous.
If the statute is ambiguous with respect to the meaning of the term independent medical examinations, then it is not the rule that we defer to the insurance commissioner's construction of that term unless that construction is palpably erroneous.
That is correct, Your Honor. As this court has stated recently in Kapua versus Weyerhaeuser, that you would give judicial deference to the administrative agency. However, if the administrative agency's interpretation of the law is erroneous or violates the spirit and intent of the law, then no. This court takes a look at it de novo. And let me, if I may,
this
and
I'm as good as reading the law as is the insurance commissioner.
I'm sorry?
We're just as good at reading the law as the insurance commissioner.
Exactly.
Because it's a question of law.
Correct.
But so really there are two aspects you're arguing. One is, I guess, the cost side. If, as Justice Levinson said, you have an in-house nurse, an in-house doctor, in-house adjuster, conceivably that doesn't increase the cost, right?
Correct.
Because if they're employees of the organization, they're going to get paid whether they do the review or not.
Correct.
So if you exclude that opinion or the opinions of those people, as the trial court did, then you're not intruding upon the prerogatives of the insurer. Isn't that correct?
They can hire those people to make those kinds of decisions.
Use that information for whatever purpose
they
want.
That is correct.
But
until they decide to deny the benefits based on a medical opinion.
But, you know, giving full, I guess, credit to what the legislature says, when it says independent, I guess it means independent, and when it says medical, it means medical. There's the other aspect of this is just fairness. That if you're going to say you need an independent medical examiner and that the parties have to agree to that person and that if they cannot agree, you can go to a court to have that disagreement resolved, then does it make sense that if that procedure has not been followed, that the court has the discretion to exclude the opinion that was derived outside of that process?
Yes, Your Honor, that is true.
Why?
Well, there's several different reasons. Number one, they made reference to the case of TIG versus Kalhani, where in that case the insurance commissioner excluded or basically defaulted the insurance carrier. And they're saying that a judge in the circuit court cannot default the insurance carrier by excluding an improper medical opinion. And that's not correct, Your Honor, because there is a difference. Administrative agencies are creatures of law, and they have their powers based on that law. The courts, however, have a much broader inherent power, and that power is to control the fair administration of justice. And if I may use the example of the fruit of the poisonous tree, that where illegal searches and seizures garnered improper evidence, the court had the perfect right to exclude that kind of evidence. So clearly, Judge McKenna has the right to exclude anything that's ill-gotten or improperly gotten from the actual hearing itself. Yes, sir.
From a practical standpoint, would it be fair to say that an independent medical examination won't be arriving because there's a dispute between the parties?
Well, it can arise where there is a question as to whether regarding either the treatments themselves that are being rendered or the condition of the claimant. There may not necessarily be a conflict. The insurance companies certainly have the right to question treatments because that's what they're there for. The statute is sort of a check and balance statute.
Isn't it true, though, that Section 431.10C 304, subsection 6, makes reference to 431.10C 308.5 in reference to disputes between the parties?
That is correct. 304, Your Honor, talks about when there's a dispute on the charges. In other words, how much the doctor is charging. 308.5 goes much further into where there are disputes as to the appropriateness of the treatments, the frequency of the treatments, and or the necessity of those treatments.
I understand, but wouldn't 431.10C 308.5 kick in because of a dispute? Namely, the insurance company does not want to pay because they believe the services rendered either is unreasonable or unnecessary. The insured believes otherwise, and that's why there's the imposition of the independent procedure.
You're correct, Your Honor. 308.5 was designed or created as a check and balance system. So if the doctors were overcharging, they were checking that. They also allow the insurance carriers to retain outside medical opinions to challenge the appropriateness of the treatments. So yes, that's usually a dispute.
So prior to any dispute arising, if the insurance company hired a doctor to review these records, there is no dispute at that point. So wouldn't 431.10C 308.5 not kick in yet?
Well, if the, yes, it does kick in, not necessarily because of the dispute. It kicks in because there's a cost limitation there. You can't go out and hire a doctor and pay him anything you want, which is what they did in this case. If you're going to hire a doctor to render medical opinion, the statute kicks in because of the cost factors first. The second reason it kicks in is then the legislature is saying, and if you're going to have that medical opinion, make it fair.
Any further, Mr. Chang?
Your Honor, unless the court has more questions, I would like to rest at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
5 more minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to follow up on Justice Lee's question because it is entirely pertinent to this analysis. Ms. Gillen's physical condition was not what GEICO was concerned about. A medical examination of her physical condition at the time she started treating with Dr. Keller wasn't the question that GEICO wanted answered. GEICO didn't even get to the point of going into 308.5. There's no pretense here that GEICO's expert review was independent. There's no pretense here that it was a medical examination. It was overtly an effort by an insurance company to determine if the claim in front of it was connected as required by the statute as a result of a motor vehicle accident that happened 9 months earlier. The physical condition of Ms. Gillen did not inform that decision. The expert review of medical records did. GEICO never got anywhere near the considerations of 308.5 precisely because Ms. Gillen's physical condition was not at issue. The issue was causation. There are multiple tools available to insurers, whether you begin with an adjuster's review of records or a bill auditor's review, anywhere along the line, that they may make decisions on criteria, whatever it is and how meritorious it is, or what they have available.
Counsel, and are you arguing that a dispute between the claimant and the insurer with respect to causation cannot generate an independent medical examination?
I'm saying on these facts it did not, and I'm not speaking to potentially what other situations may exist. But in this situation, it was the cost-effective approach because GEICO would never ask for an independent medical examination because Ms. Gillen's physical condition was never at issue.
But holding cost-effectiveness aside, concern with respect to the causal relationship between a present complaint and a past injury or accident can precipitate an IME, can it not?
I'm sure it could. Yes. But in this...
Is it your argument that, at least in this case, Section 308.5 isn't even implicated at all?
Precisely. That is correct, because GEICO wasn't asking for an independent medical examination. It had no intent to have her physical condition evaluated. They were simply calling upon expertise to inform their decision to pay or not pay. And the question was whether Ms. Gillen's claim was meritorious or not. And the reason that that's important is the balance of policy interests in these first-party claims processes are that the claimant gets speedy reparations, the insurance company make its decision within 30 days, and that unmeritorious claims not be paid with an obligation on the insurers to report potential violations of the statute to the insurance division. I'm not suggesting Ms. Gillen's claims were other than a mistake, but the question of the insurer's ability to review that based on its own expert's assessment, someone who can give the insurer a timely opinion from an individual in whom the insurer has confidence, is fundamental to fair claims review process and fits precisely within the balance of interests created within the claims review processes set out by the legislature and the statute.
Ms. Sigam, I don't have any problem with the insurance company conducting its own evaluation, however it wants to do it in-house. But I suppose when Judge McKenna issued her order, she was concerned that the use of that kind of information should fit within the statute, i.e., you know, the insurance company can do whatever it wants to come to a decision, but when it purports to or proposes to place that information in evidence for the purpose of denying fees or to challenge whether a threshold has been met, then in that instance, the kind of evidence that should go before the court should be evidence from an independent medical examiner. Do you have any problems with that?
I do, Justice Okobe. May I speak to those concerns?
Yes.
In our brief, we cited four opinions from the administrative hearings review process where a denial of PIP claims had been made based on a record review alone. In each of those that we cited in our brief, the ultimate conclusion at the end of the evidentiary hearing was that the denial was proper. In that context, the only context presented before to the trial court to understand what the evaluation between cost of having a records review and the benefit of insurers being able to make a timely decision so they don't pay unmeritorious claims. The only record before the trial court were four situations GEICO presented where the denial based on a record review was ultimately upheld. There is no case before the trial court that said there was an abuse, that somebody had wrongly been denied treatment by the use of a record review, or that it was extraordinarily costly. There's no evidence before the trial court that there were extraordinary costs related in any particular situation that would compel the court to act as a legislature, to make that cost-benefit assessment with no evidentiary record. Just
on. I ask you, in those four cases, were adjusters involved in the denials?
The adjusters issued the denials, but in each of those four cases, the denials were based on record reviews done by physicians hired by the insurance company. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Chang, do you have anything else you want to say? You were supposed to go first.
I actually had a question for you, and I think by rights, you could have spoken first, and you would have rebuttal time, and you didn't use all your time. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to the argument that Section 308.5 isn't implicated at all in this case?
I totally disagree with that, Your Honor. And the reason being is because what are we? It's a question of form over substance. And the form that they're arguing about is, well, if we don't call it an IME, if we don't call it a physical exam, we just call it a records review, then we don't have to comply with the statute. The substance is what I think Your Honor hit on when it talked about, is there case law that defines an independent medical examination? And yes, there is. And Black's Law Dictionary 8th edition says a independent medical examination is an assessment of a person's physical condition, usually by a doctor or a healthcare provider. And I think that's really the key, is that there is an assessment here by a doctor that they hired to assess the plaintiff by way of the records. And if you look, and it's already in the records as to what Dr. Hector said, Dr. Hector said that her ongoing symptoms are based on poor posture, poor sleeping position, bad mattress, and bad pillow. And that's the kind of medical opinion they gave to deny her benefits. And that's what I think the legislature is trying to prevent. If we're going to do this fairly, if we're going to take away statutory benefits from people, well, let's do it in a way that's fair and just, without a unilateral hiring of a doctor to say anything the insurance company wants to deny those particular benefits. And that's really the key to this whole statute. It's the substance. It's the medical opinion. That's what the legislature is trying to control. And if you're going to have a medical opinion insurance company, make it fair.
The term IME itself is malleable. I mean, you have an IME under the federal rules. Clearly, if the legislature intended that, they could say as set forth in the civil rules of civil procedure. You have an IME as defined by Blacks, but here the legislature has, in effect, defined it in a different way.
That is correct, Your Honor. They talked about, they gave insurance companies the parameter. If you want to do a physical exam, if you want to do a records review, fine. They then defined who the medical examiner could be. They said, number one, it had to be an in-state provider. Even though Dr. Hector has a license in Hawaii, his practice is in California. They also said that independent medical examiner must be someone that is a treating physician, one that treats people here locally, because we don't want the kind of examiner that only does this for a living, that does this for one side.
In the same field as...
Correct, and the same specialty, because that was something that the doctors asked for. It wasn't from the claimants. The doctors asked for that because, as this court has said on many occasions, the real party in interest is the doctor who gave treatments and had it denied and never got paid. He's the real party in interest, and what are we doing to our doctors if we don't allow them to have a say? And they did, and that's why the same specialty provision was put in there, because they wanted to have a doctor reviewing their treatments, because that's all done by records, that's of the same specialty. In Weigel, the case that the insurance commissioner ruled on, we had Dr. Nakano, a neurologist, ruling on a chiropractor. That's what the doctors were opposing. And they're saying, if you're going to do it in such a way where you pick someone that is knowledgeable about the field to which I have been treating this particular patient, and then decide whether you should pay my bills or not. But it's the doctors that are being the real party in interest, and they're the ones who, if you don't, if you treat them poorly like this, why would they continue to treat no-fault patients? And we already have that problem now. Because they're treating someone, they get denied, and they can't collect it from the claimant, so they go unpaid. And that's what the legislature is trying to avoid.
Thank you all, counsel.
Thank you.
Take this matter under advisement.